It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Morning and welcome to Legal Defense. Hey, if you hear some birds chirping and cars driving by and stuff like that, it's because we are at the WHBL mobile studio with modern day technology, putting us in the great outdoors. Thought I'd take a chance to enjoy some nature while we're doing the show this week. So, for starters, I know this entire week we've heard more than we ever want to hear about guns. I'm just going to say a couple things about it and then move on. And frankly, I think that the media has been saturated with enough commentary about what we should or shouldn't be doing at this point. The only thing I want to say is that I'm at the point where I just don't know anymore. I used to think that my views on regulation of guns were pretty sound. I'm just starting to question everything that I thought I knew. And I don't mean this in a political way. What I mean is that I'm struggling to come up with a logical solution in my own mind. In other words, if I were the leader of this country and had the ability to do something about it, I'm just not sure what I would do anymore. It's that baffling of an issue. I say that because this jerk, I'm not even going to say his name anymore. By the way, I've noticed some media outlets have taken to not saying this person's name anymore, and I agree with that completely. We're going to call him the shooter because he doesn't deserve to have a name. But this guy legally had his weapons. He's an American-born citizen. He was being monitored somewhat by the FBI. But, you know, when it really comes down to how could this have been prevented, it's just such a myriad of issues that it's really heartbreaking that no matter how much we try to live in an organized, regulated society, and no matter how much each of us put effort and thought into how we can live in a safer world, stuff like this just keeps happening. And while I sympathize with President Obama's desire to affect change, I'm just not sure what we do. I mean, is it possible that the only answer is to have some sort of radical change in our view of guns in general? Is that going to save lives? I just don't know. Or do we just regulate a little more, a lot more? What do we do? I mean, this is another example of somebody that was dead set on creating havoc. The point has been made, which is true. You really can't debate this. If he didn't have automatic weapons and didn't have those types of resources, he would have used something else. It could have been it could have set a fire. It could have been anything. And how do you regulate that? That being said, it does sort of throw us all into a tailspin of havoc when we're trying to figure out how we address these things. But I'm sure you all have had plenty of opportunity to think about this issue all week. I just wanted to comment on the fact that I find it highly distressing, and in fact, it's just causing me to question some of my own, what I thought were pretty secure views on how we go about regulating this kind of thing. And I'll be honest with you, I thought that if we can identify those areas of people that should not have firearms, and if we keep expanding those categories, unfortunately what's happened is the exceptions have swallowed the rule. It's not really clear anymore about who should and who shouldn't have firearms, because hey, I mean, this guy by all legal means was entitled to have and buy very very destructive weapons. I mean, it's just kind of how it happened. So anyway, wanted to switch gears a little bit. There was an interesting story that came out of California earlier this week, and I only comment on it because in our political times, it's an interesting thing. Judges in California, just like in Wisconsin, are elected. So when they face re-election, they have to be judged by the public based upon their record, not only on how they performed in court, their whether or not they've been appealed, that sort of thing. But yeah, they have to answer to the public, including public opinion and that sort of thing. When it comes time for re-election, they have to prove themselves. So there's this judge in California that during his last term, there was an investigation into his activities that occurred in chambers. And turns out that he had a bit of a habit, if you will, of romancing female staff and lawyers that practiced in front of him, to the extent that he utilized his own judicial chambers as a sort of playboy playpen, if you will. And the investigation started. He cooperated fully. He admitted to engaging in sexual conduct with people that, by the rules of ethics, he's prohibited from doing. He was forthright about it, you know. Technically wasn't breaking any laws, but certainly is something that you're not supposed to do. And one of them was an intern, so she was somebody who worked for the judge. Another female was a lawyer that practiced regularly in front of this judge. And there were some implications about whether he should have recused himself when acting as judge in these types of cases. But anyway, bottom line is, and if there's a lesson to be learned here, he was open, forthright, admitted exactly what happened, not much dispute about the facts, ran for re-election, and guess what? The people of California re-elected him. So apparently it did not reflect upon his qualifications as a judge. And, you know, it's a bit of a funny story, but it also kind of reflects on one very small point. That is that I suppose that in the modern era, when we're all supposed to guide our conduct according to good morals, good common sense, but bear in mind that it's very hard to keep secrets, you know, nowadays, for one reason or another. I mean, the main reason is because we're being monitored all the time. Anything you say is being recorded. Anything you do is being monitored in some way by video or otherwise. And you know, if you do something wrong, it's going to come out. So while not condoning the actions of a judge that would do such a thing, I guess I'm impressed by the fact that his honesty, forthrightness, and acknowledgement of his shortcoming, and apparently a promise to right the ship, so to speak, went a long way with the voters in California. Now, this is the same state that elected Arnold Schwarzenegger as their governor, so, you know, maybe it's just a reflection of that. I'm not sure how he would have fared in our good state of Wisconsin, but it kind of segues into another issue that I kind of want to focus on this week in particular, and that is this whole concept of how the rules of ethics, and when I say the rules of ethics, I mean specifically those rules that are adopted by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. In order to understand this, you need to know a little bit about how the legal world is regulated. It's a little different from other things that are regulated in the sense that not only do we have the Board of Bar Examiners and the Supreme Court, which regulate lawyer conduct, but we also have a set of ethical rules. They're not laws, but they are regulations in the sense that they are binding because they are connected with that regulatory function. So look at it this way. If you have a driver's license, or for that matter, a fishing license or a hunting license, or probably more appropriately, like a license to practice medicine or a license to be a chiropractic practitioner. These are all things that that license is connected with making sure that the person who holds that license maintains certain professional standards. And those are embodied, at least in the legal world, by these rules of ethics. They go beyond just what is legal and what is not legal. So in other words, the general public is guided by the criminal law as well as a series of other laws that guide behavior, make things legal, make them illegal, allow certain types of activities, disallow other types of activities. But regulatory functions are more, as I said, connected to one's privilege to practice law in a particular area. So when a lawyer goes through the process of obtaining that license, of course, there are some prerequisites. Generally speaking, the most standard way that one obtains that license to practice law is by going to law school and then either passing the bar exam or being admitted on what we call the diploma privilege, which is something that does exist in Wisconsin. And either way, it's a method by which one submits an application to the Board of Bar Examiners in any given state. And then there is a fitness, I don't mean physical fitness, I mean moral and character fitness examination, more or less, that occurs, which means they look and see if you have any kind of criminal record, if, you know, if you've done things that don't reflect well or wouldn't reflect well on the profession. So, but that's my little intro. We'll talk more about how the rules of ethics have an interplay in our criminal justice system when we come back right after these messages. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 101.5 WHBL.
Welcome back. You know, in real life, I mean the life that all of us lead, not just lawyers. In real life, we have ethical guidance that comes from your mother, your father, your school teachers that you hopefully paid attention to in high school, mentors that you had over the course of your life. But it's not against the law, in most cases, to fail to abide by those basic rules. Let me give you a good example of what lawyers are required to do tied to their licensure. If I come home and my wife asks me, "What did you have for lunch?" a literal interpretation of the rules of ethics require that I give a truthful answer. I may have gone out and had a hamburger, and I may not want to admit that because my wife likes me to eat healthy, but the rules of ethics theoretically require me to give a truthful answer. That's because there is a rule that says in dealing with other parties, a lawyer must be truthful. You know, there is no law that says general citizens, people in the public, are required to tell the truth. Did you know that? But there is a rule that requires lawyers to do that. But let's talk about why. Because lawyers have an enhanced level of responsibility in our society that's recognized by the fact that we have this additional layer of, I guess, public protection is one way you can call describe it. And it's recognized that lawyers have the ability, in some cases, to take advantage of somebody who is in need of legal services. So these ethical rules are really designed to, number one, set a high standard of conduct, you know, much like the military, where we try to define what that ideal soldier will reflect in terms of good order, morale, discipline, etc., and have that reflected as a strong moral basis for what lawyers do and how they should conduct themselves. But I want to direct the discussion specifically on how this relates to the criminal justice system. And I've said this before and commented at various points on my show over the years, but I think it's true that we still live in an era where our process of seeking the truth, particularly in the criminal justice system, is one of the most primitive things that we do. In fact, it hasn't changed very much over the past 300 years or more. The idea is that we put it in the context of an adversarial system. It's the defense versus the prosecution, and both sides engage in a tug of war. And we have this belief that if both sides pull hard enough against each other and try to outwit each other, try to out-strategize each other, and put it all in front of a judge or a jury, particularly in the case of a jury, we believe that if you bring 12 people together that are theoretically disinterested in the case, are not affiliated with one side or the other, and let them debate what the facts of the case are, we have this sort of mythical belief that we'll get the right answer. It's really like blind faith when you think about it. There aren't that many things in life other than religious beliefs where we put that much stock in something that the dynamics of which we really don't understand. Because after all, a jury deliberates in secret. The lawyers aren't allowed to go back there and watch what the jurors do. They can do anything they want. They can talk about the case. They can not talk about the case. They can vote guilty for someone who's really not guilty and not guilty for someone who really is guilty. It's all completely within the realm of having that, you know, authority as a fact-finding body. And the reason I say it's somewhat primitive is that if you look at other things in our culture, we have ways, every day there's some new medical technology that exists. We're connected in ways via the internet and our little electronic devices and everything that surrounds us in terms of modern technology to an extent that 10 years ago or certainly 20 years ago, it would have been impossible to imagine those advancements. And look at how technology has evolved over hundreds of years. I mean, 100 years ago, you could not have imagined in your wildest dreams. It sounds like stuff from science fiction that we would be doing all the things we do now, like your car knowing where you are by using GPS satellites, by being able to track where your kids are because you know where their cell phones are, having access to the world's knowledge by means of the internet. I mean, these are things that you'd have to be one of the most imaginary science fiction writers of all time to be able to have accurately contemplated all of those advancements. We have cars now that can park themselves. Pretty soon we're going to have cars that can drive themselves. We have robots that make stuff and do things. And we've created machines that far outthink the capabilities and limitations of the human mind. In the criminal justice system, we still do it the same way we used to do it, by simply having people that get in a room and argue about stuff. I don't want to be too critical because it still is the best method that exists in the entire world for fact-finding, and we've done everything we can to try and make sure that those results are just. But as I've said many times on previous shows, it wasn't that long ago. I could take you back 15 years, and it would have been very hard to identify an actual case with supported facts where someone was actually convicted of something they didn't do. That used to be a widely held belief, not only publicly, but also within the judicial system, within the criminal justice practitioners' world, that we just had faith in the outcome. You know, hey, if the jury found him guilty, there's some reason. You know, whatever it was, you know, it's a result that we can hang our hat on and rely upon. We now know that that is so far from reality that, you know, it causes a lot of us to have shrinking faith in how things work in that justice system. But just another aspect, again, tying it back to the rules of ethics. We have these set of rules such as, like I said before, telling the truth. You also have to, a prosecutor has to seek justice, not a conviction. That sounds great, but what does that mean? Okay, how does a prosecutor say to him or herself, am I doing the right thing here? Because you're also supposed to be adversarial. You're supposed to try and advocate for a particular position. That's your job. It's recognized that we're in a battle. And you go to battle to fight the battle. But there's this, you know, sort of subjective, relatively unenforceable provision that says a prosecutor must personally believe beyond a reasonable doubt that someone is guilty. When you're in an advocacy role, and I'll be the first to admit, when I'm defending somebody, I believe in that cause. I give it my all. I do everything I can to fight for that person. It's something I'm very proud to do. But I also admit that I wouldn't be the best person to make the final decision about the truth of the matter, because I'm playing an advocacy role in that process. It's my job. It's my responsibility. It wouldn't work at all unless I am fighting for a particular position. Now, I think it's easier for the defense to do that because I believe very strongly in our constitutional rights. I believe in making the government do their job, forcing them to do what they've promised to do, which is, you know, try cases, prove facts. And it shouldn't be easy for them to get a conviction. That's all part of the law. It's all part of the bedrock of our legal system. But you look at the other side of it, and I acknowledge that it's very difficult for a prosecutor. I was a prosecutor years ago in the Air Force, and half of your brain has to say, look, the system will work if we push our agenda as hard as we can, because the other side's pushing as hard as they can, and we'll let the jury sort it out. On the other hand, we acknowledge that there are certain human elements of the criminal justice system that cannot ever be removed, such as bias, prejudice, subconscious bias and prejudice, things that a juror might not even be aware of. And then the thing that really makes this all the more confusing on a philosophical level is that when both sides are engaging in this adversarial system, the goal is to sway a juror's opinion. That's what both sides are doing. So think about it this way. In a system whereby the choice of words when asking a witness a question, the inflection in one's voice, for that matter, the color tie you wear, these are all things that we think about and stress over because we're worried about the impact that it has on that particular advocate's ability to sway that juror towards one side or the other. Well, time for a break, but we'll continue the discussion right after these messages. Stay tuned.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear on 1330 and 1015 WHBL.
Welcome back. Hope you're enjoying your cup of coffee. I'm enjoying mine in the great outdoors. Can you hear the birds chirping? It's a beautiful morning. So, more on the topic of the regulation, so to speak, of the legal system and the criminal justice system in particular. Just before the break, I was talking about how curious I find it that we have so many elements of subjectivity that go into this process. We throw it into this adversarial process. We throw those facts to the jury and let them decide what's going to happen. And it has this sort of mystic quality where we don't know what the jury does, but we just hope that they get it right. And as I was saying before, you know, as an advocate for the defense, you hope that they get it right and that you've done a good job. But just so you understand the things that go through my mind when I'm getting ready for a trial, you know, I have the benefit of getting the perspective of my client, which is something the prosecutor doesn't have. I admit that. But I'm provided the evidence in the case. I do my own investigation into the facts. And you basically assemble the things that you want to present and how you're going to deal with the other side presenting their facts. And let me just deviate for a second here to talk philosophically about how our country, in particular, by utilizing the proof beyond a reasonable doubt standard, is supposed to promote justice. It's often said that trials are not about what actually happened, but what can be proved. And that really is an accurate way of describing the litigation process, because the layers of evidentiary rules that affect what a jury can or cannot consider, which, by the way, are imperfect. We're trying to approximate what would prejudice a jury if they heard it. And a lot of jurors are sometimes upset to hear that they weren't allowed to consider certain evidence. I mean, I'll give you a great example. Let's talk about a drunk driving case. Because if you are a juror in a drunk driving case, you're not allowed to know if somebody has prior convictions for drunk driving, because it's deemed to be too prejudicial. And I acknowledge that that is something that if you were a juror and you knew this wasn't this person's first time around, you might not be willing to give the person the benefit of the doubt. But when you tell jurors after the fact that, hey, guess what? This person's trial was for a third offense or a fourth offense or something like that, universally they say they would wish they had known that. You know what I mean? We also have all these rules that deal with things like hearsay or foundational issues and things like that. And it's really a way where judges, lawyers, etc., have substituted their common sense and judgment for a would-be juror's ability to sort these things out. There's a theory that if we didn't have these rules of evidence and just every single conceivable fact that has even limited relevance, including a person's character, including good deeds or bad deeds they'd done in the past, who likes the defendant and who doesn't, just a full-blown expose on anything that may have anything at all to do with the case, that we would trust the jury to sort it all out on their own. And I admit, there is some appeal to that because if we really do trust jurors to get it right, why wouldn't they get it right if they're able to pay attention to what is important, what isn't? But instead, what we do is we have these rules of evidence that say, okay, a typical juror, whoever that is, won't be able to focus their attention appropriately on the real issues in the case, which are decided ahead of time, both by the legislature and the jury instructions that are approved by the jury instruction committee, and the law as interpreted by the judge and advocated by both sides. So, you know, when you're actually in court and you're actually trying to introduce and argue over what evidence comes in and what that evidence means, that is the end of a process that has already occurred outside the presence of the jury through pretrial litigation, discovery procedures, and so on, where it gets distilled down to what the lawyers decide are the facts that the jury should hear. Now, doesn't that seem a little odd that we're substituting judgment for what is and what isn't appropriate? And we lawyers spend a lot of time arguing in an imaginary world what a juror should or shouldn't hear. And it's all based on pure speculation about what the effect of a particular fact would have on that person. You know, I mentioned character evidence before, and I get this question all the time. Can we admit character evidence in as part of our defense? Sometimes yes, but generally the law says that character evidence is irrelevant. Now, why is that? It's really based on the idea that trials are not supposed to be a popularity contest, and that trials do not determine the quality of a person's character and therefore whether they're guilty or not of a crime. It's supposed to be focused on, did the thing happen that day or series of days specifically? And the law does not like to put into the mix any kind of judgment about the type of person that's on trial. Now, there are many exceptions to that, but that's the general rule. But let me get back to the ethics, because ethics are these nefarious sort of loose rules that are supposed to guide this whole process. And the regulation of that process, let me just point out how this works. If someone violates one of these ethical rules, let me pull one out of the box of ethical rules that I have here. Let's see. Let's pull one out. Okay. A lawyer shall not request an adjournment for purposes of unneeded delay. In other words, you're supposed to be ready for trial, okay? What does that mean? And and who enforces that? And what is the judgment that comes into play in doing so? Let's be honest. There are times when a prosecutor in particular is overwhelmed because of their duties, and we could blame funding for that. We could blame management for that. You can blame judges for that. You can blame all kinds of things. But the reality is that most prosecutors have more work on their plate than they can handle. One traditional method of regulating that is, you know, seeking adjournments in cases that you need more time for stuff. And sometimes, again, since we're talking about a very subjective standard here, you know, there has to be some, I'm not going to say manipulation, but control over how the system progresses. And it's pretty common that it's very obvious that a prosecutor, for example, has 10 cases set for trial next week. The judge expects that prosecutor to be ready for all 10 cases with all of their witnesses and to be preparing for all 10 cases simultaneously. It's natural that a human being in that situation would want to know, can I focus on this particular case? And there are certain obviously legitimate things that are done in that process where the prosecutor can and should attempt to resolve as many of those cases as possible, figure out where the real controversies are, and then take that case to trial. But, you know, as luck would have it, oftentimes that isn't possible because the real controversies are ready to be tried and need to go in front of a jury. So then we have the time pressures that happen because of the fact that we do live in a world that has a 7-day week and there are 24 distinct hours in each day. Part of those 24 hours have to be spent sleeping, eating, hopefully some personal hygiene involved in there. But the realities of life make it so that the ways that we deal with managing the great deal of responsibility that we as human beings have when it comes down to I need more time, sometimes that is questioned by someone who hasn't been involved with that level of preparation, namely the judge. So sometimes I do have sympathy for the prosecutors that are struggling with this process. And we hear it all the time, and I can't really disagree that you know, we should have more funding, we should have more staff. If we're going to be more effective on reducing crime in any particular community, we have to be willing to spend that money. We need to be able to spend taxpayer dollars. But don't forget, every dollar you spend towards prosecuting somebody, you have to spend another dollar on defending those same crimes. That's logical. Here's why. Because the defense is 50% of the process. The prosecution doesn't simply pick cases to prosecute, obtain convictions, and go on their merry way. Our system recognizes that under the Sixth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause, that part of this process is that a person is entitled to have their rights advocated for vigorously. Vigorously. In the context of this adversarial battle. You cannot pour more funding into this process on only one side. If we do that, not only do we lose faith in the integrity of our system, but we end up spending more money in the long run. Because we'll have ineffective counsel, we'll have issues that should have been explored that weren't, we'll have appeals that go on and on forever, we'll have wrongful convictions that the state can and should be liable to pay people for their wrongful incarceration that occurred over the years. Time for a break, but we'll be right back after these messages. Please stay tuned.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bare on 1330 and 1015 WHBL.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed the show. I try pretty hard to make it enjoyable. You know, one unexpected consequence of doing this radio show over the years is I've really gained an appreciation for the community we live in, you know, beyond just the obvious things. But, you know, living in Sheboygan has been a wonderful thing for me. I've been here for, boy, almost 20 years. And I've never lived in a place where you drive down the street and everyone waves at you. You walk your dog and you pass by your neighbors and it's just natural to have a conversation about life. People are very open, very friendly. But obviously I have some controversial views on many different subjects, and I subject all of you to those views on a weekly basis, and it's up to you whether you listen or not, but practically every day somebody approaches me and tells me how much they appreciate listening to the show. And many people don't agree with what I have to say, but they still appreciate the dialogue and appreciate, you know, having the opportunity to think about these things. And, you know, I like to think that I'm not the kind of radio host that engages in a bunch of spin doctoring or sensationalism or anything like that. There's an occasional bit of levity that's thrown in there, but in general, it's really just an opportunity to listen to the radio and think about stuff, which is one of the great things about life. So my little philosophical moment for the week. But I wanted to tell you something. Most of you know that at a previous point in my career, I was a prosecutor. And I just wanted to tell you something. I don't think I was a very good prosecutor. Not because I didn't win. I won every case I ever tried. But because I was 26 years old when I started prosecuting cases. And there's a saying that if you, at the age of, I'm now 50, if you're the same person you were a quarter century ago, there's something wrong with you. And I agree with that, because I wouldn't have known it when I was 26, just starting this career path, because you think you're smart, you've gone to school, you've gone through the fairly arduous process of obtaining that law degree. I got my commission as an officer in the Air Force. I thought I was hot stuff. And when you're given the task of having that responsibility to regulate other people's conduct because you're prosecuting crimes, it's very easy to tell yourself that you're doing the right thing. It's very easy to tell yourself that you're right and other people are wrong, because everything seems so black and white. But I'll tell you, going through that process of having a stack of folders on your desk, and you go through one at a time, and a 26-year-old person makes decisions that affect other people's lives permanently, is something that, looking back, I just don't have faith that I had the maturity to do it the right way. And I'll be honest with you, a lot of times decisions were made for the wrong reasons. I mean, I'm not comfortable saying that, but I will admit it. The wrong reasons being somebody else in my chain of command thought it was a good idea to prosecute somebody for something because of an agenda. I mean, the military is just like any other prosecutorial organization that has priorities. And there were times when certain hot issues were ones that were being focused on. And at the expense of, I'm just going to come out and say it, at the expense of true justice, an agenda was being pushed. The ethical side of me kicked in frequently and said, should we really be doing this? Should we really be trying to get a conviction out of this case? Because we know we can, but should we? And I'll tell you, it's very difficult for someone very new in their career, and let's face it, prosecutors tend to be people that are very new in their careers. There's not a whole lot of prerequisites before somebody enters the prosecution mode. All you have to do is get hired, basically, after you have your law degree. You have to be qualified, so to speak, but there's no special set of standards that apply to prosecutors. I mean, a kid in his or her early 20s, mid-20s, applies for a job at the DA's office, seem like a sharp person, seem like they can handle their workload, seem like they've got a good work ethic, and they're hired. Nothing more than that. Really, just, hey, try hard. That's all you got to do. But there were so many times when I remember thinking to myself, this is bizarre that the government spends a great deal of money training prosecutors to obtain convictions. I went to all these different trial advocacy schools, and the gist of every single one of them was, here's how you can stop the defense from winning. Here's a way to outsmart the other side. Here's a way to trick the other side. You know, all in the name of obtaining a conviction. Like a game of chess. You know, there are rules that apply to a game of chess. You can move certain pieces in certain ways. But beyond the basic rules, you don't tell the other side what you're going to do. You don't map out your moves ahead of time. You take your moves one at a time, and you attack the other side. And you try to catch the other side unaware of what your overall strategy is. And you hope to capture the king at the end of that process. Chess is just like the criminal justice system in that sense. Now, if you add to it, prosecutors sometimes get to play chess with some extra players, and they get to bend some of the rules. Some of their knights don't have to go two spaces forward and one space in either direction. They get a little bit more leeway, you know, in terms of how they do things. So getting back to this whole ethical principle, and my point here that I learned a lot over the years by prosecuting cases and then ultimately defending cases, that this is serious business. And, you know, whether you're having a good day or a bad day as a human being can affect other people in such dramatic ways permanently. And I think back to people that I prosecuted where I really wasn't sure if they were guilty or not, but I told myself that the jury will get it right, and as long as the jury finds the person guilty, I don't have to lose any sleep over it. But I do. You know, many years later now, I think back to cases where, you know, I knew very well that I had the upper hand because I was utilizing rules that were designed to give me the upper hand, and it felt like I was, you know, protecting the world. But that's a dangerous process. It really is. I mean, you know, God bless the people that can do it, that have the right sense of responsibility, and we need that. But, you know, there really isn't anything that stops a prosecutor from seeking a conviction rather than justice, other than opinion. As I said before, there's that ethical rule that says a prosecutor shall seek justice and not merely a conviction. How can you tell the difference is really part of the problem. Well, hey, I've waxed poetic long enough here. Let's just talk about a real news story. There is a case currently underway in Fond du Lac, this cold case dealing with a gentleman who was originally a suspect in abducting and killing a college student out there. And after years and years and years of investigation and the case going nowhere, the crime goes back to 1990. The thing that changed the course of investigation was, at least as it's reported in the media, a fingerprint. A fingerprint. I want to tell you something about fingerprints, because you've probably heard before that there's this theory. It was actually developed in the 1880s. That no two fingerprints are alike. This was not based upon studying everybody's fingerprints and seeing if they match or not. It was just a theory. It was an idea. And it was actually a convenient idea, because if that were true, if we can pretend that's true, then it's a means of solving crimes, right? Because if you find perpetrator's fingerprint on the crime scene, you can solve the case. Well, what we know now, much like snowflakes, do you think that all snowflakes are different? Turns out they're not. And in laboratory settings, you can duplicate that crystalline structure precisely and exactly. Fingerprints are the same way. And it has now been proven on a forensic level. And in many jurisdictions, fingerprints are not even admissible, because of the flaws affiliated with the basic theory behind whether fingerprints prove what they purport to prove. So it'll be interesting to see how this case continues. It's got quite a ways to go. I think they've only called a couple of witnesses, but we'll have an update next week on how things are going in that trial in Fond du Lac. In the meantime, I hope you have a pleasant weekend. Enjoy whatever it is you're doing. Tune in next week right here on 1330 WHBL. On both AM and FM if you choose, or download the podcast and listen to it at your leisure. Have a good weekend, everybody. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk O'Bear.